It's officially summer, and since we're at the height of the outdoor grilling season, and with the weekend just a few hours away, today's edition of Please Explain is all about hamburgers. I am joined, and I am so happy to be joined, by George Motes, photographer, filmmaker, and author of Hamburger America, One Man's Cross-Country Odyssey to Find the Best Burgers in the Nation, and Josh Ozersky, a writer for New York Magazine and author of the recently published book on this subject, Hamburgers, A History. So great to have you. It's great to have you because you're two handsome guys, but you brought burgers into the studio, which is really a great thing to do.
We don't travel anywhere without hamburgers.
Right. That's good. Okay, Josh, in brief, who invented the hamburger?
I maintain in my book that the hamburger was invented in 1916 in Wichita, Kansas, by a man named Walter Anderson, a fry cook, who later went on to found the immortal White Castle chain.
Okay. Now, does a hamburger have anything to do with the city in Germany of Hamburg?
Very little. I think that that is a canard. People used to talk about
it. Well, you can see why people think
it's not
an irrational conclusion.
No, no. I mean, clearly. I mean, you could see how the world was misled. But the various things that were called Hamburg steaks over the years were like different kinds of cured meat, scraped meat, meat cakes, salted patties. Not anything what we would recognize as the universal sort of semiotic hamburger image, which is defined, and I think you'll agree with me, George, by a white enriched bun on either side of it.
Well, now, George, it's a very happy environment here in the studio because we are all smelling these delicious hamburgers, but I sense that you are not entirely in agreement on the question of who invented the hamburger.
I really don't think there's any way to definitively prove who has invented the hamburger in America, though.
But do you have a theory?
Well, I do. I think that I can definitely say that there's a place in New Haven called Louie's Lunch, which Josh does not agree with at all.
Josh, all right. You know, it's okay to disagree. That's where we're happy.
But you have to agree that Louie's Lunch can definitely be – it can be proven that it is the oldest continually operating hamburger restaurant in America.
I don't think that can be proven, George, because as I say in my book, the next hamburger that Louie's Lunch serves will be its first.
Because they serve something called a hamburger sandwich because it's served on toast.
No, it's on toast.
And then do you believe that the bun is a factor in deciding whether something is a hamburger or not?
I would say that it's the definitive factor.
Really? Well,
yeah.
That's interesting. I would not have thought that. Why do you think the bun is so important to the process?
You know, Chesterton once said that the essence of any work of art is the frame.
Yes, I wasn't aware that Chesterton said that, but that's a part of the work of art, I guess?
Well, no. I mean, it's what defines it. And the thing with there's been ground beef in one form or another for almost all of human history, right? I mean, maybe the Earl of Sandwich at his gaming table put it between something or someone else put it on a matzo, whatever. But the hamburger, semiotically speaking, didn't shimmer into being until the day that someone designed a bun specifically that fit it. And when you think about your image of a hamburger, the image that everyone recognizes in their mind, it's of a circumference totally flush between the bun and the meat.
That's true.
It's a designed object, that is to say, like a seahorse or something.
George, do you think that the bun is that critical to the whole hamburger experience?
I do. I think something that's uncomplicated in a burger is very, very important. You know, a very uncomplicated squishy white bun, a very uncomplicated beef patty that has nothing put in. It's unadulterated. It's not full of, you know, onions and egg and all that kind of stuff that would turn it into a meatloaf. I think it's very important.
Okay. So we're going to talk a lot more about hamburgers, but we're also going to take your call. Questions about how to cook a hamburger, your personal hamburger recipes. We are at 646-778-3729. That's 646-778-3729 or 646-SPUDRAY. Now, the spud is not a reference to potatoes or french fries. It's just a coincidence, but 646-SPUDRAY. Okay. Where did the word hamburger come from if it didn't come from hamburger?
Well, the word is a holdover from what was known as Hamburg steak, which essentially meant various kinds of meat cakes, right? And so when they would sell little meat cake sandwiches on a piece of bread or whatever, such as like at Louis, which are, you know, Louis is kind of like a proto-hamburger ancestor, right?
It is like a Neanderthal.
Like the Australopithecus of the hamburger Australopithecus family.
That's Louis in New Haven. Yeah.
And so like when they sold that, it was natural for them to say, here's your hamburger steak sandwich.
which they still say, by the way. They still call it a hamburger. They do call it a hamburger steak sandwich.
It's hamburger steak sandwich. All right, George, how did you get involved in the hamburger history field?
About 7 years ago, I made a film called Hamburger America, same name. And we profiled 8 different hamburger restaurants around the country. And, you know, we looked at the stories and realized it was more – it was equally about people as it was about the hamburger itself. So this became a very full, you know, rich film about people who make hamburgers and a real story about America. So we did the research and found out we had enough research to make a book. So we ended up rolling the research into a book of 100 different places.
Now, one theme of both of your books is that hamburgers are a uniquely American food. Is that not true of hot dogs?
I don't think it's at all true of hot dogs.
Why
hot
is that?
Dogs are a uniquely German food. That's, I mean, the you know how the hamburger.
Well, I mean, no food is an original.
I think hamburger is original.
As you just said earlier, people ate ground beef elsewhere.
Well,
no?
Right, but that's not a hamburger. I mean, a hamburger is something that came into being in modern times in the public sphere and has an identity apart from its constituent elements. And if you take. Well, on the other hand, you could make the argument, George, you might agree that the German Wurst, they don't have the white enriched hot dog bun. Maybe once it goes on the white enriched hot dog bun, then it morphs into an American version that's as distinct as the hamburger.
It's true, but I still think that the hamburger is a truly proud American icon. There's no question about that. I think it's also one of the only American food inventions of the last 100 years. Definitely one of the most important.
We're talking with George Motes, author of Hamburger America, One Man's Cross-Country Odyssey to Find the Best Burgers in the Nation, and Josh Ozersky, author of the recently published book, Hamburgers, A History. Two great scholars on the subject. What's a slider, George?
A slider. Well, that's what Walt Anderson invented when they started making White Castle hamburgers, right, Josh? I mean,
yeah.
The slider is it's a squashed meatball. It's cooked on a griddle with onions that have been steamed into the burger with a bun that has been placed on top of the burger to steam with it. And there are very few places in America that still make real sliders. One of them happens to be a place in New Jersey.
I've noticed actually in recent years, maybe I'm making this up completely, but in sort of fancy type restaurants, you will often see something called a slider and it will be 3 little hamburgers on a bun.
Right.
But that's not a real slider.
Now, a real slider has to be cooked on a well-seasoned flat-top griddle, cooked in its own grease, and it has to be cooked. I think if you're selling maybe 1,000, 2,000 for lunch, you're making the right thing.
Well, there's also a morphological question, George. You know, like the sliders in the nice restaurants are always big things. The real slider should be almost like a meat petty four.
Okay, let's go to a call here because I think Thomas in New Brunswick has a great question. Thomas, ask away.
Yes, my name's Tom. I appreciate your time, and it's a very interesting I think Americans love hamburgers, basically. And my question is, do the hamburger experts feel that a hamburger made outside with the same ingredients is better than something you can make inside? In other words, the old-fashioned outdoor charcoal grill, can you do better out there, or do you have to be inside? And
Josh Ozersky, what's the answer?
No, it's worse.
Outdoors is worse. Wow, why?
Well, George has eaten so many great griddled burgers. I think he should answer.
I can tell you this much. It's actually one of the hardest ways to reproduce great hamburger is outside. Uh-huh. It's very hard to do. It's one of the hard – people think you can go home on the weekend, fire up the grill, and make a great burger. It's actually the hardest way because you actually have to, you know, contain the juices in that burger somehow, and people have a tendency to press on it and push all the juices into
it's
the griddle.
It's hard to tenderize.
It is hard, but it is – all right, yeah. Let's talk a little bit about making a great burger. Hold on. Thanks so much, Thomas. Let's talk about seasoning the ground meat. Should you do it? Should you not do it? Because I don't know how you guys feel about the book, The Barbecue Bible, by Rockland.
Stephen Rakeland,
which is a book that's in our family. He says, basically, do nothing to the meat. Salt, pepper, that's it. Well, what do you think of that?
No, George and I are both minimalists to the core. We don't think there should ever be ever more than salt and pepper.
So I'd say just salt even.
Yeah, maybe even
really,
just salt.
If you have really great ground chuck, ground shoulder, all you need is salt.
And what's the best kind of beef?
But can I add one thing about seasoning?
Please.
George makes the point about the griddle, and I agree too because the griddle's a perfect medium for a burger because there's nowhere for the grease to go. So it kind of confies in its own fat.
Mm-hmm.
But the griddle that's a million years old sort of seasons the meat too.
No question.
Greater than any herb or anything like that.
Now, my wife's father, my father-in-law, in Cincinnati, would always put barbecue sauce in the meat before he cooked it. And that was her platonic ideal of the hamburger. But you both are shaking your heads.
No, there's too much sugar, and you end up with this high sugar content in barbecue sauce. It doesn't work with the meat at all. It's hard to cook it.
That's like a manwich.
that's a bad thing. As hamburger historians, are there regional differences in how people cook hamburgers? Obviously, there are individual places cook them differently, but is there such a thing as a southern hamburger or a western hamburger?
Not so much in the way we would think of western or southern, but there are definitely regional differences. I mean, the way I pointed out in my book was that regional uniqueness abounds in America, and people don't even know it. I mean, people are unfortunately been so snowed by this, you know, this fast food model where you can get the same burger in California that you can get in New York if you go to one of the big fast food chains. But the reality is that if you go to, for example, the center of Oklahoma, you're going to get an onion fried burger, which is basically a burger that has onions pressed into it. And pretty much if you ask for a hamburger, it's going to have onions pressed into the meat.
God, that sounds so good. And I've never had that.
It's fantastic.
I've never had an onion pressed in. But that's standard operating procedure in Oklahoma City,
outside of Oklahoma City, just pretty much anywhere in central Oklahoma, you're going to find onion fried burgers. If you go to the Pacific Northwest, all their burgers have a sauce on it called goop. Goop.
Really?
Goop is only
what
it's
is
very
goop?
Simple. All it really is a little bit of, I think they won't really tell me. It's always about secrets.
Mystery, yeah.
Always about the mystery of the recipe. What they do is they take I think it's sour cream, mayo, and mustard, and that's pretty much it. It's a very sort of pasty spread that goes on every burger, and you can't ask for a burger in the Pacific Northwest and not get goop on it.
Well, I suppose for better or worse, Josh, we can't talk about hamburgers without talking about McDonald's. And is McDonald's has the pervasiveness of McDonald's changed the hamburger experience in the United States?
I don't think there's any way you could say that it hasn't. But and the McDonald's,
how has it changed?
Well, I mean, the thing about McDonald's is I think McDonald's is an entity so vast and powerful that it's made people, especially progressive people, think of hamburgers as symbols of conformity, cultural imperialism. I think in my book I describe it as, you know, I mean, a sinister object served by wage slaves to an obese population. You know,
I'd say that's pretty good. But you think that's an unfair caricature of what a hamburger is?
Well, I think it's not only an unfair caricature of what a hamburger is, but I think it's an unfair caricature of McDonald's. The middle chapter of my book is almost a panegyric to McDonald's as a American institution that I think is much less appreciated than it should be for what it is, especially in its early years.
Hey, great question here from Virtue in Manhattan. Virtue, what's your question?
Hi, I just wanted to know what you guys think about cheeseburgers and adding cheese, because I always do to my hamburgers.
As many do. I am the only member of my family who chooses not to eat a cheeseburger. But what do you think about the institution of the cheeseburger, gentlemen?
I'll eat a cheeseburger if that's what everyone else is eating. If I walk into a restaurant and every burger has cheese on it, that's what I'll have. But if no one's eating cheese, I won't eat it. I mean, I don't think it's actually that important. If you have a really good beefy burger, you do not need cheese on it.
Now, I know, Josh, we've had a debate here about the origin of the hamburger. Is there any consensus on the origin of the cheeseburger?
There is, right, George?
No,
it's what's the guy's name? Lionel Steadman or something?
LA?
Pasadena in 19. It was around 1932 or 1933.
But there's also Kalen's Louisville, Kentucky. They have a claim from the early 30s.
Okay. Could we pause for a moment and have a taste test? Because we each have two. Burgers in front of us, and George, describe the two burgers and what they are.
Well, unfortunately,
and I would add, in the best tradition, all three of us have jumped the gun on the taste test and have already tasted them because
hungry.
It's irresistible, as am I. But George, help us out here.
Well, unfortunately, it looks like both these burgers are cooked on a flame. An indoor flame, which indoor flame usually means that they've been cooked in some kind of propane, butane, and you know what? You can actually taste the flame in there. You know, I don't think that you should taste flame when you eat a hamburger. You should taste beef.
So if you're cooking indoors, you should think it should be fried in a pan.
It should be definitely fried in a skillet for sure.
A skillet, okay.
Absolutely.
And okay, so let's try it out. But one of these is a cheeseburger, I think.
Well, I think they're both cheeseburgers.
Oh, they're both cheeseburgers.
To have a level playing field, but let's all take a bite of the bigger one.
The bigger one. Okay.
I got a smaller bite of the smaller
one. I think it's the big one. Josh, can we say where this came from?
Why not? This is from Cool Blue on 6th Avenue, K-O-O-L, uh-huh. Blue. And it's a restaurant that makes a big 10-ounce burger, and it's admittedly, George is right, it is cooked on a gas grill. But to me, the freshness
– it's pretty fresh.
The beefiness and the fact that despite it being a 10-ounce burger, it's still expanded horizontally rather than vertically.
Right. I am not a great fan of the really, really fat hamburger that's hard to get your mouth around. I don't think that improves the experience particularly.
No, it disimproves it. That's another thing that's not a hamburger. A hamburger has to be a disc. Once it becomes like a spheroid or planetoid or something, it's veering off into, heterodoxy.
So this one, it's a big burger, but it is pretty flat, so it's easy to eat. Okay, now let's move on to the other burger.
They're both actually also preformed. They're not hand padded at all.
Oh, how can you tell that?
I can mostly tell from the edge. And you can also tell from the – I'm breaking it open right now. I'm taking a look at the inside. And you can tell the way that the meat is sort of laying flat. All the grains are laying flat.
Now, how does that affect the taste, the fact that it's pre-assembled?
Again, it depends on how you cook it. But in most cases, a preformed patty is not going to ever taste as good as a hand-formed patty.
Okay. I tried the second one. Where's that one from?
That's from the Vandam Diner.
And, I don't think it's as good.
It's bad.
Why is it bad?
Well, I think the main reason that it's bad is it's a frozen puck that's probably from some place like Sysco. The big difference is that the other place does –
You mean Costco?
Well, there's a thing called Sysco.
What is Sysco?
It's a restaurant supply company that provides everything from hamburgers to napkins.
To forks and stuff.
Yeah. And a lot of places get – you can see that there's a kind of a density to this, an almost wood-like quality that's the hallmark of freezer burn and dehydration.
But you can also there's a marbling in there that you can almost see like where the frozen has thawed.
When I was a prosecutor, I had a summer intern whose father ran a Greek diner. And one of the things that always amazed me about Greek diners is the incredible length of the menus, just how many hundreds of things you could order. I always wondered, who goes to a diner and gets a leg of lamb? I mean, it just didn't seem
– Or a lobster.
And he said, you should be sure only to get hamburgers because other stuff, even that freshness is a problem. I mean, do you think freshness is a problem for hamburgers?
Yeah. I mean – it's a problem. It's one of those things that there's two tiers of hamburgers in the world. There's frozen and fresh. Whether it's formed in a machine or by hand or whatever, there's different methods. But somebody that takes a piece of meat and grinds it up or has it ground up for them from a Pat LaFreda or one of the good purveyors, they're in a different business than someone that's getting a box that says hamburger. And it's the same. The box that says hamburger that you get in the freezer – that's the thing that's made from 100,000 different animals and may or may not have germs living in it.
And even if it's not, it's been packed at the meat packers, and it's not going to be a very good hamburger at all. What happens, whenever an animal goes into the slaughterhouse, the first thing they do is take off the best cuts. Within a few seconds, I think, all the best steaks come off first. And if you can go to a butcher and buy meat and grind it yourself, that's where you're going to end up with the best possible hamburger.
I'm with George Motes, author of Hamburger America, One Man's Cross-Country Odyssey to Find the Best Burgers in the Nation, and Josh Ozersky of New York Magazine, author of Hamburgers, A History. We are taking your phone calls. We have a bunch of great calls. We're going to get to as many as we can at 646-778-3729. And you're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show. This is Jeffrey Toobin of CNN and The New Yorker, pinch hitting today for Leonard Lopate. We are talking about hamburgers with George Motes, author of Hamburger America, and Josh Ozersky, author of Hamburgers, A History. We have a lot of great calls, and I think we are going to start with Arthur in Manhattan. Arthur.
One of the great indoor sports in New York is the year-round competitions for lists of the best burgers by Chow, Yelp, New York Magazine, and many others. I wonder if the guests have a nominee.
Come on, best burger in New York.
Oh, I can't tell you.
I
play a game with my friends called
Top Five.
I can't.
So name a couple.
Well, we do this thing. We do this thing called Hamburger GPS, which is where a friend of mine will call me from anywhere in the country, and they'll say, "Well, I'm in Minneapolis. What do I do?" I'll say, "Make a left," and I'll talk them into the nearest great hamburger. So I can tell you from where you're sitting right now, you know, where the best hamburger is from where you're sitting.
Manhattan,
the nearest.
Manhattan West Side.
Manhattan West Side.
Well, I would send them to Big Nick's for starters.
Right. Oh, gosh. What a great choice, Big Nick's.
You're wincing, though, George.
You're not a fan of Big Nick's?
It's cooked on a flame.
Well, he doesn't have the good fortune to live in Hackensack or the place where Hildebrandt's is.
West Side.
Josh, talk about some great hamburger places in New York City.
There's a hamburger that I'm inordinately fond of at a place called Seymour Burton Restaurant on East 5th Street between A and B. That's almost a perfect hamburger, even though it's unorthodox. It's on an English muffin, which I don't approve of. Very good. There's a hamburger at a place called The Good Fork in Red Hook that I love. I love the hamburgers that are made at Stand, at the Shake Shack, at the Spotted Pig. But really, the hamburgers that I love best aren't to be found in New York, the little thin griddled patties. We really can't. The only place you can get that is there's a place near Mineola called Hildebrandt's. That's an old-time ice cream parlor that's my single favorite burger in the entire greater New York area.
Arthur, can you quickly tell us your favorite place to get a burger?
P.J. Clark's.
P.J. Clark's?
You know, I just had a P.J. Clark's burger not even an hour and a half ago.
That's good. Okay, Chachi in the Bronx. You have an interesting question about McDonald's.
Yes, how you doing?
Good.
Questions. I noticed outside New York, for some reason, they put mustard on the cheeseburgers at McDonald's. And I figured that company would be like across the board, you know, having everything the same. I'm wondering if they have some kind of corporate, you know, bigwigs at the side where the taste trends are going in America.
George, you have an answer about the mustard on the McDonald's burgers.
I'm not sure exactly why McDonald's sort of strays from their business plan with the mustard outside of New York City and L.A., but I do know that if you try to get ketchup on a burger outside of New York and L.A. in the center of the country, it doesn't really exist. Nobody really puts ketchup on their burger except for, you know, the East Coast and the West Coast.
Really?
It's always mustard, pickle, onion. In fact, if you walk into some of the greatest, you know, slider places in Ohio, it doesn't exist. I mean, they'll actually have a thing on the menu that says no ketchup.
One caller wanted to know, where do you still get a slider in the New York area?
I think one of the most historically significant hamburger restaurants in the Tri-State area is White Mana in Hackensack.
In Hackensack, New Jersey.
Yeah. I mean, it really is. It's the original White Castle model.
Well, White Castle is the original White Castle model.
Well, except that they've kind of strayed from there.
I mean, they're worse, but they're still more or less, you know. They're devolved slightly.
They have devolved, and what's happened is I think that the original business plan, the idea that, you know, that Walt Anderson had in 1921, still exists at White Mana.
David in Brooklyn, you have a good question.
Yeah, well, I just got married. And we have this gigantic KitchenAid mixer sitting on the counter. And I heard you talking about cutting the best cuts of meat and grinding it yourself. Do you have a preferred method and preferred cuts of meat that you would use?
Josh, go ahead.
Well, the preferred cuts of meat generally for burger should be ground chuck. And then I like to put in a little bit of hanger or short rib for an extra richness, an extra beefiness. But more important than the cuts is the ratio of fat to meat. The best possible ratio of fat to meat for my money is 70 to 30. And the more the less fat there is, the worse the burger will taste.
Now, that is often the case that the more expensive is worse then.
Yes, like a sirloin burger typically
is a mistake.
I think so, yes.
Absolutely.
Why? Because the fat does what?
It creates flavor. Fat is flavor.
I see.
You know, the fat is the meat and the meat is the vegetable.
Have you both been to DB, the Daniel Boulud's restaurant with the famous hamburger there that has foie gras in the middle? Is that what it is?
Yeah. Daniel Boulud.
If I could only capture for our radio listeners the expressions on both of our guests' faces when I mentioned this very expensive burger, it was pained. So what do you think about this burger, Josh?
He's a great man and a great chef, and I have only the highest regard for him as a force.
Likewise, I have likewise.
But I said to him, I mean, it's not a hamburger. He's doing a hamburger restaurant, and it'll be hamburgers. But you know, that burger was like it was put on as kind of a gag, and it saved the restaurant or made the restaurant. But it was
he knew that, though.
Yeah. It was like a sitcom that brings on a zany neighbor, and then he takes over with his catchphrases. You know?
I see. So George, you're not a fan either.
I believe there's three different types of hamburgers. There's a hamburger that's unadulterated, there's nothing in it, but maybe salt on top. There's the hamburger that's stuffed, that becomes meatloaf, and then there's Daniel Boulud's burger. It's in a category to itself. I mean, it's almost like a compartmentalized burger. He even serves it. He cuts it in half and serves it to you open so you can see what it looks like on the inside, which is, I think, it's a mistake, because then obviously the burger stops cooking.
Well, and then we have
breaking news here on the Leonard Lopez Show. John, I understand there is hamburger cooking going on as we speak. This is a real time call. Is that right, John?
Are you talking to me?
Yes,
John,
I am. You're okay. John from the Upper West Side.
First of all, I've been making him. It may be too long, but my mom used to have a delicatessen with this wonderful German lady, and all the ends would be cut up. Pastrami, hamburger, you name it, bologna. And she would cook these things just for me. And they were full of fat, obviously, because bologna, a special kind of bologna, was German bologna from Schaller and Weber. And these turned out to be, when my friends came, they had to have this, like a hamburger. Now, my hamburger, but I have a hamburger history here. And I have a house on Black Island where I grill with applewood on an open flame over a cast iron grill over bricks. So we're talking some professional stuff here. The Fairway has the best, Chuck. It goes out there. You go there at 9 o'clock, 8:30 in the morning.
Fairway Chuck. Okay.
You get 3/4 of a pound. It's so fresh you can't, it's perfect. I get 3/4 of a pound because we don't eat too much. Cut it in half. Make my own little patties. And the idea of an English muffin is it keeps it down to size and gets you the right thickness to fit. Now, here's the thing.
Okay, all right.
This is my kind of guy.
The program is only 2 hours long, so you got to try to focus the question.
Grind pepper on one side. You let it sit there for about a half an hour, and then you put it in the frying pan with no grease, a really seasoned frying pan, a hot sizzling frying pan. It hits the frying pan and it goes chow. The grease melts and it doesn't stick. On the other side, you've coated it with either Coleman's or Roland's hot mustard. Not a lot, just a little bit. And you let it cook like that.
You know what, John? I'm just going to have to stop you because I'm afraid you may have a cardiac event discussing this. It's so exciting. So I think that was a very interesting possibility, but we want to try to get some more calls in. And Sam in Rockland County raises an entirely new issue, which we haven't gotten to yet, which I think is very, very important in the hamburger discussion. Sam, welcome to the Leonard Lopez Show, and talk to us about your question.
Oh, hello. Actually, I wanted to hear that recipe.
Well, see, you can't please everybody. Go ahead, Sam.
No, I was talking about toppings. And
toppings,
there
very
was
important.
One thing about California puts mayonnaise on the burger. So this is something I grew up with when I was little there. And also the mustard thing.
That was shocking to me when our guest said that that mustard was so common outside the coast, because I always thought mustard was weird on hamburgers. Well, not hot dogs, but weird on hamburgers.
You know what's interesting? I'm sorry, I don't mean to interrupt.
No, please.
But both whether it's mustard or special sauce or mayonnaise, any of those things actually serves a kind of a culinary function that a lot of people aren't aware of. When put on the bottom bun of a burger, it keeps the grease from it acts as a kind of like a prophylactic, a gastronomic prophylactic, to keep the grease from sinking into the enriched bun.
Yeah.
What other toppings, Sam, do you like?
Well, the different kinds of onions, raw onions and fried onions, is a big argument.
Very good question. What about now? We're talking with George Motz, author of Hamburger America, and Josh Ozersky of New York Magazine, author of Hamburgers: A History. What about raw versus cooked onions?
There are a lot of raw onions out there, and especially in the center of the country, there's lots of raw onions, but also lots of cooked onions. I mean, their onions are big out there.
Well, what do you like better, George?
I prefer – I just discovered it actually for the first time about a week ago, why I liked it, but it was the Vidalia onion.
You like a raw better?
No. I prefer a sautéed actually cooked into the burger, like the onion-fried burger we were talking about.
Yeah, that sounds great.
Vidalia onion.
Josh, what's your thought on onions?
I like a thick slice of a red onion or a Vidalia onion – because I like it.
But not cooked, raw.
Raw. Because I don't believe in tomatoes or lettuce or any of that stuff. The only cold element that I will have on a burger is that onion, and the only sort of textural contrast between the viscous yellow cheese and the hot meat and so forth.
Okay, we're trying to get in a few more calls here at 646-778-3729, 646-778-3729. We're talking with George Motes and Josh Ozersky about hamburgers. George, I this is a little bit of a weird question, but I understand you're in a mixed marriage.
Yes, I am.
Explain that.
My wife's a vegetarian.
Yeah, how does that work?
It works actually very well because if you notice, I'm not some oversized human being. I am very healthy thanks to my wife. I mean, I go home and I don't eat a whole lot of meat at home. We keep vegetarian at home, and then I go out on the road and I go meat crazy basically. So it works really well.
It works well. That's great. Here's Stosh in Brooklyn. Very important, good question on the whole burger issue. Hi, Stosh.
Hey, how are you? Hello?
Yeah, please, go ahead with your question.
You guys haven't talked about the actual doneness of a burger, rare, well done, medium.
Very, very important, good question.
And, some restaurants refuse to serve it to you like medium, rare or rare.
Well, that's recent in my experience, that a lot of restaurants now won't serve a rare burger, or at least they say they won't.
They kill a burger, basically.
And well, first of all, why does this policy exist, and what's your... You gentlemen think about what's the appropriate doneness for a burger?
The policy is a result of the E. coli scare. And George and I can speak for you safely, George. We consider it an abominably misguided and draconian policy. I think that I would rather live in a world where people eat tofu patties than have to eat only well-done hamburgers. I agree.
But I think the also well done, and it gets kind of confused when you, like, for example, Five Guys, they cook their burgers through. They say they cook them well done, but they're just really cooking them through.
No, it's gray, though.
But it's still moist and juicy, though. And that's okay to me. And I know where you're coming from
I have a confession to make. When I'm cooking hamburgers, particularly on the grill, which is mostly how I cook them, I have a great deal of trouble telling where they're done. And I have been known to break one open. Now, I know that it's the juices out, and I would like to say that I always give myself that hamburger and give my family the better looking burgers. But how do you tell without cutting open a burger how well if it's done?
Well, one of the best ways to do it is you've ever done the fist test. You can't really see on the radio at all, but there's a certain fist test you can do where you squeeze your fist, your thumb in your fist, and you can actually press part of your skin right there. And that's a medium burger right there.
It's hard to describe what George is doing, but basically what he's saying is that when you touch it with your hand, if it's soft and yielding, that means it's rare. And if it's hard to the touch, like you were touching the tabletop, then it's very well done.
But if you have this sort of little bit of give here, that's
a little
actually
bit of give,
medium
that's your
burger.
Medium rare.
That's the best way to tell.
Okay.
The worst thing to do is to break it over.
Try to get a couple more questions here. Christina in Greenwich. Go ahead. What's your question?
Comment. There's a place that opened about a year ago in Port Chester called Burger Shakes and Fries, and it is a very, very simple sort of doorfront, but it serves the best burgers, and they're absolutely plain. The meat, I'm sorry, it's very unadulterated meat, like you were saying, but so tasty. But what makes it is they use white bread grilled like a grilled cheese with the butter on it.
Patty
and
melt.
That's how they serve it.
And what's your thought about that approach?
Well, that's what's called a patty melt. And it's a noble thing, but a kind of a hybrid sandwich, really.
And it's also closer to the Louis Lunch original hamburger steak sandwich, because it's served on toast, basically.
But is it, though? I mean, a grilled cheese sandwich is slathered with delicious margarine or butter, the Louis sandwich is just
dry toast. Dry toast, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
I have been unsuccessful in my attempt to preempt the entire day's programming on WNYC to continue this conversation. But George Motes, author of Hamburger America, and Josh Ozersky, author of Hamburgers of History, no more pussyfooting around from both of you. The best burger that you've had ever in your life.
I cannot do it because the problem is I'll tell you why. The reason I can't do it is because I have learned
you're
so much.
Out, that's
well,
why.
Basically, but I'm whipping out for good reasons because I've learned so much about hamburgers that it would be impossible. It would be like choosing a favorite child.
Just a favorite, I couldn't do it. Josh, can you step up on this?
Yes, I'll step up two different ways. The best hamburger I ever had, period, was a hand-formed hamburger made to me on a late night in Austin, Texas, at Dirty Martin's comeback house.
You know what? I think we had a caller. I couldn't get to that call, but who was referring to that very place in Austin, Texas?
I mean, I'm not saying if you go there now, you're going to get one, but at that
Dirty Martin's in Austin.
It was everything that I ever loved or hoped for or dreamed about.
Well, I thank you both, George Motes and Josh Ozersky. I have had a little hamburger, but I want more after this conversation. Thank you all for coming on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Thanks for having me.
Leonard is back on Monday, and he'll be speaking with the director of HBO's gritty new miniseries, Generation Kill, about Marines in Iraq. Also, Stefan Fatsis on what it's like to become a Denver Bronco for 3 months. Then, a new documentary about building a very controversial equestrian statue to a questionable hero in New Mexico. Plus, three former Peace Corps volunteers look back and ahead. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neshek, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Catherine Ident, and contributing producers Virginia Doris and Bonnie Lefebvre. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Jeffrey Toobin, and today for Leonard Lopate, thanks for listening.